Channel One Right. This is the new reel, Barbara 8, and the beginning of Channel One Right. This is a continuation of the talk after supper on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, 69. The continuation of the talk from the last reel on Wednesday after supper, the 3rd of December, 69.
Well, those neck muscles can be developed by training.
Yeah.
Trudy had a bottle horse, and she was worse than Missy because she not had gotten into the habit of getting above the bit and practically stargazing. In other words, she'd have her nose up and her neck actually hollow, u-necked, which Missy is not.
Mm-hmm.
And Trudy, before she bought the horse, asked Seega if there was anything that could be done about that u-neck. And Seega says, yes, 6 months of lunge work.
Uh-huh.
And that would be 15, 20 minutes a day of lunge work with side rein. Would take care of that u neck. Her neck did, but Trudy never got around to lunging her. Trudy would ride her, but Trudy never seemed to have time to lunge her. So the horse was in the same state when I left that she was when Trudy bought her. But Missy could, I think, could do well. I don't think it'd take too long. She needs a lot of lunging because she's gotten very stiff.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll help the neck muscles also. The thing you want to be sure you do is to shorten the side reins. As she raises her head, she'll raise her head herself.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're lunging her, make sure she doesn't laze. In other words, make sure she trots, and it may have to be a fast trot at first. And you watch. And if they're lunging and they're trotting and their head comes up and those side reins get slack,
then you have to tighten
them. I've got to tighten Pussies. But you don't want to tighten them so that if they bring their head up, if they get in their head in a comfortable position, that it's still pulling on them. It should be relaxed then. It should always be so that they have a reward when they get their head in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to force the place.
Then you have to just watch the side reins, and you'll have to show me how to fix that.
There's no great trick to fixing them. I'll show you that. But the only other thing you can watch is if you've got a sandy place where you can see how the horse's hooves are hitting the ground. And watch to see whether the hind legs are following the forelegs. If they're in the same track, it's good. If the hind legs are going to the outside of the circle, then your circle is too big. And if the hind legs are coming to the inside of the circle, your circle's too small for what your horse can do. And eventually, a horse should be able to trot and keep his hind legs in the same track as his forelegs on a circle with a diameter of, it's 8 meters, whatever that comes out to in feet. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think they give it in radius there, don't they?
Yeah.
I forget what they say. Sounds a bit small to me. You should be able to easily canter a circle in 10 meters and trot a circle in 8 and walk a circle in 5. But you can't do, now let me see, you can't do a circle, or you shouldn't do a circle, smaller than 18 feet in diameter,
mm-hmm.
twice the length of the horse, because his spine won't bend anymore than that.
Yeah, I understand that.
the difference between feeling that your horse is going sideways with you, and feeling that, see now, when if you were talking Western, you'd say, well, you talk and go up to somebody and say, well, look, that horse looks pretty good. He follows his nose. And you look at these pictures of these cutting horses, and every one of them that's supposed to be a champion and has a good picture. Now, you can get horrible pictures of champions, and mostly, I hate to say it, but in these magazines, most of the pictures they get are not good pictures. They almost never are. It's so difficult to get a good picture. But even so, you look at the cutting horses, and read a little up on it in these Western magazines, and pretty soon you get the impression that what they're talking about is the same thing as this. Only this is more refined. It's got all the theory and a little bit of scientific research and centuries of practice behind it. A bit more than the Western does. Western's countryfied and folk, and putting language is easy for all you guys to understand. But following a horse's nose, those cutting horses, the spine, if they're turning after a cow, they have their head low, but the spine is bent right with it. Mm-hmm. And that's what they call following a horse's nose. And they don't like a horse that won't follow his nose. And Pussy won't follow her nose. She will some of the time, but not always. And that's what got me so mad out there when I was rounding up cattle tonight. She was going sideways at the doggone critters, and that didn't help me a bit. It's not any fun to ride a horse that's trying to trot sideways, especially when it's trotting sideways in the opposite direction from the direction you want to go. He could get her head down to the ground and lope, because she won't reach for bit at all at lope now.
That's the way he rode her. I never saw her with her head up in a lope.
And he never had her head up. And he never rode her in a trot. And I guess I didn't notice enough about following the nose, but he could certainly round up cattle in a canter and with her head down.
Yeah.
And that's the way he rode. That's the only way he knew how to ride. Like I told you, Johnny wasn't interested in anything about a horse except a working horse. And he'd swear that it never gave him any pleasure to go out and throw a saddle on a horse and just go for a ride. He had to have something in his mind to do with that horse. Say, the only thing that made his day was to fool around with a horse.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to be fooling around with a horse for some purpose.
Oh, yes, we had hot pudding. Huh?
I asked Barbara if she didn't miss those English puddings with sauce.
Sauce.
Yeah.
And I said so too, because I thought it was just delicious. We had a hot pudding tonight, but no sauce.
And then we were talking about teas. And you asked me about... Faye said, I said something about it, our teas. And Faye said that she thought it sounded like they were just some time to fill up in between. About the middle of the afternoon. And that's about what they were. Especially when Mrs. Parker was there, because her food, her lunches were terrible. Now, Mrs. Tilks were pretty good.
Mrs. Parker's was starchy?
Well, it wasn't just that they were starchy. She just wasn't a very good cook. and the serving somehow managed to be pitifully small of the meat. And everything, you filled up on potatoes and... pudding, if you could stand to eat the pudding. So tea time, we just fill up to make up for lunch. And Jane came later than I guess she was about a week or so later. And by that time, you know, we those of us who'd come at the very beginning of the of October were old hands. And she came at tea time, and her parents got her settled up at the house, and Mrs. Tilk told her, "Now you go down to the stables, down to the club room, and you'll meet all the other girls and so forth." So she came down, and it's just her first time away from home. She's just out of school. And I remember she came into the club room and looked vaguely as if she were about to cry. And sat down in the red chair that I've got the most marvelous picture for Barnaby in. It was just a little straight back chair over in one corner, and there was a couch, a divan, two couches, and two great big comfortable chairs, and she sat on this straight back chair over in one corner. And we were all sitting around the table, which was over to one side, and had benches, and we had some chairs around it, and we were all around the table, because it was tea time, eating and joking around in that careless sort of way, and we tried to get her into the conversation, and we'd talk, "Where are you from, and how long are you going to stay," and that sort of thing. She wasn't very talkative, and she just sat there and watched us. And afterwards, every once in a while, we would come to the three of us, Trudy and Jane and I, would get together and we'd talk about how we felt the first day we were there. She says, "I'll never forget the first day I came. I came down to the club room, and I walked in, and there were a whole crowd of you around this table. And before I could even look, you'd consumed a whole loaf of bread, half a pot of jam, and a plate full of tarts, and you were complaining because you were out of bread." And that little, she says, "You just never seemed to stop. You'd finish one piece of bread and jam, and you'd start on another."
So you nibbled, and that's not nibbling, though.
That was not nibbling,
no. You just filled up.
We're filling up.
And you gained.
Yeah, we all gained.
On bread and tarts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At tea time.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I was much more impressed with Mrs. Tilk's banana spludge, though.
Never heard of that.
Not many people have. Banana spludge is, I don't know whether it's peculiar to the Tilks or what, but we never would have had it except for those two Jersey cows. Because, you see, with those two Jersey cows, she had her own butter and her own cream. And she would, what banana spludge was bananas mixed up in one of those mixers with cream. Thick lump cream. Oh, it was good. Oh, it was good. And she had to toss in some sugar. And
yeah, that was just Miss Tilk.
I think it was. But it was the favoriteest dessert we had.
Well, who took care of the cows, Barbara?
We did. Don't look at me like that. And every Tilk cow, except for the first one that watched the people jumping and used to get show them how, except for her, every cow the Tilks ever had, name began with A. And the current two were Amanda and Abigail. And Alice, the heifer, who was a cross between a Jersey and a Frisian, I think. During the hoof and mouth epidemic, Amanda had gotten across the fence and gone to visit the Frisian bull next door, which was strictly against the law. And the result was Alice, who was the contrariest, meanest looking, ugliest calf I've ever seen. But Amanda was, she got it from her mother. Amanda was had horns and a rather mean look in her eye, though she absolutely never did anything. And Abigail was little and not as beautiful as, well, she was not as good conformation as Amanda. Amanda was big and looked like a Jersey cow ought to look, and Abigail was little and pretty, very, very pretty, and big eyes and a really sweet face and huge eyes, and she would do anything. I mean, she's just as sweet as she could be.
Both of them good milkers?
Both of them excellent milkers. It's hard to tell which one was the best because they were never were never allowed to calve very close together. So while one of them was going dry, the other one was fresh, and you couldn't tell exactly who was the better milker.
Easier to milk?
Oh, Abigail was a lot easier to milk than Amanda. Amanda didn't do anything. She was just hard to milk. And Abigail was easy to milk if you could get your hands on her. She didn't move or anything, but she was so small. And she was the one. It was rough. Milking was rough when both cows were fresh. And you had to milk twice a day. And you had two people milking. It took up about an hour, morning and evening. And that cut into your time badly. If you had horses groom and everything else. And then if you had extra duties. See, so a lot of the extra duties went by day as well. And somehow you could never seem to get your milk day on a different day than all your other day, once a week things came. So you'd have them all on one day, and that would be run. Just run every place. That was hectic.
Well, you didn't have to wash up the vessels.
No.
That was in the kitchen.
No, Miss Thornett did that. We had to milk the cow and take the milk cans up to the house and strain it. And that was all we had to do. Had to do with that part of it. Mrs. Tilt and Mrs. Thornett took care of the rest. Abigail was everybody's favorite, especially Celia. Celia loved Abigail. And around April, she calved. And I remember the day she calved, somebody came up to lunch and said, by the way, Abigail has calved. So after lunch, we went dashing down there to see the new calf. And it was a bull calf. And that upset Trudy because Trudy was vegetarian. And she knew that a bull calf would be sold eventually as a feeder because the breeding is so strict in England that there's no reason to keep a bull that can't be used for breeding. And no bull but a champion that's been shown all over the country is used for breeding. So there's no any other, all the small farmers sell the bulls for feeders.
Do they?
Pretty much. Not all together, but pretty much.
That's what we ought to do. It's a great loss, not to.
Pictures of him when he was only a couple of hours old and still wet. And picked him up. I'll never forget Jane. Jane is little. She was a little shorter than I was, but stocky built. And that little girl was strong. And she said, well, this was midwinter. It was still awfully cold. We had snow just before that. And she said, we can't leave him out here. He'll get cold. And she just reaches down and picks the calf up and starts walking off. Well, I couldn't have carried that calf, but it was a good good down the length of a lane or more to where the shed was. And I can heft right good weight, but I don't think I could have carried that calf all the way to the shed, especially since he'd had his first milk. And he was beginning to feel that he could move a little bit by the time that we got to the shed, and he was kicking up a fuss. And we got him to the shed and milked Amanda, milked Abigail. And that night, we looked in on her, and she was weaving, just standing there weaving and rolling her eyes and looked sort of weak. And the next morning, she was down. She was down and out so bad that you could touch her eyeball. She never even blinked. And we called the vet, and he said, get her up into a natural lying position. And so Jane and I went down to get the cow up. And we couldn't even move her head. Nevertheless, get her head up and curved back around over her shoulder like it should be. And Mr. Tilt came down, and he tried, and he couldn't get it budge her. We were trying to wedge a bale of hay. Just move her a little bit and wedge it up so we could get her up. We couldn't do it. The vet got there. He came as soon as he could, and he took one look at her, and he lay down and put his shoulder against hers and braced. I'm not exactly sure how. He showed us how. I'm supposed to know how now. And picked her, just moved her up. And we shoved the bale of hay in. It looked so easy. He says, now you never need to do it, you know. At least I know what it looks like on the ground. And he pumped her full of magnesium. What she had was a magnesium deficiency. And he said, now don't milk her. We'll just have to run the risk of her milk souring. Because if you milk her, it takes the calcium to make the milk, and it'll just weaken her. You don't want her to have to make milk. So we didn't milk her, and then she got stronger. She was standing up within 20, 25 minutes after he gave her the shots. Bright-eyed as if nothing had ever happened to her. And she'd been as close to dead as a cow can get 20 minutes before. And she had a relapse the next day, and they came out and gave her some more shots. And she picked up again. And while she was sick, we were milking Amanda and feeding Freddie by bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun, trying to get that calf. It was a little thing that hardly even known its mother yet. Nursed from a bottle.
What sort of bottle?
We had a what was it? He gave us a thumb, one of the finger. Did they have just separate finger gloves? And he gave us one of those, and we put it over the top of a milk bottle, little pint bottle. And we fed him with that. And it would keep stopping up because the hole wasn't big enough. And we couldn't get the hole any larger. So we spilt a good deal of milk, and it was sticky stuff, get all over you. But it was fun to feed him.
You know how Miss Patterson does it. She puts it in a cup bottle and puts the bottle right down there and just turns it in. Down it goes.
Well.
And she just also feeds them Coke. She says that's good for
them.
Oh.
She's brought up with the horses on a very small scale. Her dad had ridden as a boy. You know, it had a groom and back and a pony in the stables, and had ridden as a boy. And he wanted his kids to to ride. And when they were lived in Scotland, he bought a pony for them, and then they had to sell it. And when they finally settled at Town House Farm, they got three. They had three old horses. He bought not horses that were young. Even when he bought them, they were old. When he bought them, he bought them at an age when they should be retired, and he just bought them to ride occasionally and to give them a good home. And they were still pretty spirited, but a couple of them had run away with Jane several times. But she was not even a fair rider when she came to the Tilks.
Oh.
Well, she'd only been sat on a horse. She'd never been taught. And she hadn't been even sat on a horse where she could get much experience or benefit from watching anybody else. She'd just been put on these old horses and ride up the road.
Well, I didn't know you all started them that elementary.
Yeah. As far as I could figure out, they'd take anybody who came along. But most people who decide to go and see, it was, of course, going into horses is a profession. And anybody who's made up their mind that far along to go with horses as a profession had some experience somewhere of some sort, or wouldn't usually do it.
But how did Jane make progress?
Oh, yes. Yeah. She wasn't a bad rider when she left. Not very, she was a good jumper.
Oh, really?
She was, to her dying day, she'll never be able to get out of the old English hunt seat, which was not what she was taught particularly, and certainly not what she was taught at Tilks, but she's always getting behind her horses.
Oh.
And ending up going over jumps. She would never bother their mouths. She'd just end up with her legs out in front of her and sitting shoulders back and legs in front. And she could give to their mouths and give them their head and let them get over, so. And she enjoyed jumping. And that night that Mr. Tilt got so mad at us was the first time I ever saw her ride. Now, before that, she'd been on a horse.
Hey, make sure. No, I can't.
Okay.
I can't listen.
All right, let me just put
this. Before that, she just sat on a horse. She would never do anything. She wouldn't use her stick. She wouldn't use her legs. She was a completely passive rider. A passenger, completely and utterly.
I understand that.
And
a passenger rider.
Yeah. You know, she'd just get in, sit there, and the horse could take her where she likes. And that was one of Mr. Tilk's favorite. If he called you a passenger, you knew you did. You better do something, anything. But she was completely, and about her jumping and everything, she just no force at all. And that night, she got on whichever horse she was on, I forget. Kim, I think. No, I suppose it was Sheila. Some horse that was a little bit sluggish. Kim wasn't sluggish. And the horse wasn't jumping, and she beat the tar out of it. She just really led in there with whip and legs and everything and got that horse to jump. And then she got him to go where she wanted him to at the same time she was jumping. And that from that time on, she made progress. But until that night, she had not ridden a horse. She said, I just didn't ride.
Well, is that the time Mr. Tilt got you?
That's the time Mr. Tilt got me. He got all of us.
He got her, too?
Oh, yeah.
And that's how come her to get a hold of it?
Mm-hmm. But now, she was tough. There was one girl in there that just broke up completely.
You
got
had
off
to be
the,
tough.
You had to be tough. A little Canadian girl got off her horse and walked out in tears. Well, she made it through. She made it through, and she rode, well. But she was broken up completely afterwards. She just was in such floods of tears that she couldn't talk to anybody, and she couldn't move hardly.
Oh, you mean she was a casualty?
Yep. I frankly felt pretty good after it. I didn't bother to waste time feeling ashamed for the performance that I'd put in that afternoon. And I knew I'd learned something, and I was glad he did it. And I think Jane felt the same way, and Anne was crushed. I don't know. She wasn't strong anyway. Not that way. She never could decide what she was going to do. She loved horses, and she loved working with them, and she was happy as long as she was left alone with them. But no pressure. No pressure. And Jane could take it and be happy. Jane wasn't competitive at all. There was nothing competitive about her. But she never panicked.
Are you competitive?
Yeah. I'm competitive.
On a horse?
Oh, yeah. On a horse anywhere. And it hurts me if I think that I'm second rate. I know I am, but it hurts. It hurts when somebody comes up and shows me I am. That's one reason I think I've never really enjoyed showing, because except for one horse show, I've never won. I've never had, and it's been because, one reason is because I've never had the horse to win. I've never ridden a horse that was capable of winning in the shows that I entered in. And even at tilts. Now at tilts, at least I had the advantage of knowing that I had the top scores. I had the top scores in those little dressage and 3-day competitions. That ride I had on Kim would have had me winning by 5 points if it hadn't been for that choosing the wrong fence. My dressage scores were better than anybody else's, and all I needed was to have taken that other fence. And there was something, in the other one, it was a pre-caprilli, which is a dressage test that includes two fences. The one I rode Kim in was a 3-day event, a 3-way, or 2-way actually, had a dressage test and then another test over fences. They were separate and then the scores were combined. But in a pre-caprilli, there was a dressage test and included in it were two fences. And I was riding Blotch, who does not jump. He just will not jump. And I got him to jump later, but at the time I took the test, he was not jumping very well at all. And I got through all the tests into one fence, and he'd never seen anything like it was parallel. And it was low. But he came into it, and he didn't have any sense about stopping for a fence. He would go into it. Now, any other horse, if he's going to refuse a fence, will stop in front of it, not Blotch. He would get up to it, and he couldn't decide whether he was going to jump it or what, and he would get all tangled in it. No matter how simple a jump it was, Blotch could manage to get his legs tangled in it. And it took me 1, 2, 3, 4 times to get him over it, using whip and everything I had. And I finally got him over it and went on with the test. Now, my dressage score on that was the highest, but I would have been eliminated, technically, because of the 4 refusals. But they didn't eliminate me because of the horse I was on, and I placed second. Or was it third? Second or third, in spite of the fact that every time I had a refusal, that was more points off.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it doubled. Each time you had a refusal, you had twice as many points up. Mm-hmm. So it went 5, 10, 20, or whatever. I don't know. It was something like 3. And even so, even knowing that the horse... See, when I got my paper back, the comments were, besides a few comments on mistakes in the dressage, the comment beside that jump was very well handled. Mm-hmm. Because I had ridden. At least I hadn't just sat there and let the horse refuse. I had ridden him and gotten him over the jump. And that's what Mr. Tilt looked for. But even so, I was hurt because I hadn't been able to win. And I was hurt when I found out that Kim and I had missed by taking that other fence. I was furious. I was absolutely furious.
What do you do when you're furious?
I have a feeling I whine.
Huh?
I have a feeling I whine. I tend to complain.
Go down to the mess hall and just stew?
Yeah. Rant and rave a little to my friends and... generally make life miserable for everybody. Not a good proper yell and scream, because usually but whine.
This is the end of the session after supper on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, 69. This is the end of the session after supper on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, 69, about 4:65 or 70, Channel 1 right, around 4:65 or 70. The end of the session after supper on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, 69, and this is the 8th reel.
Well, this is Thursday after supper, the 4th of December, 69. Thursday after supper, the 4th of December, 69. Channel 1 right around 4:80. Channel 1 right around 4:80 after supper, Thursday. 4th of December, 69. Time went right around 4:80. Barbara, I just can't believe that misbehaved. I just can't believe it.
No, she did all right. She didn't waste any time about it either. I took her out there, and about the first thing she did was to leap up in the air and turn around and stare at me.
On the lunge?
On the lunge, yeah. And I fixed up the side reins.
And you saw that face?
Yeah. As I drove out, I almost stopped and went over there.
Well, it wouldn't have done much good.
No, I just couldn't.
Well, she kept that up for a long time. And I finally got her going around to the right. A couple of times she was really, I guess it was the whip.
Uh-huh.
because every time she'd see it move behind her, she'd stop and flinch. And every time you'd use it, instead of going forward away from it, she'd back up to it or whirl around to look at it. That could be right frustrating. And she got her trot, she would go around part of the circle real fast, and then the other part she'd tuck her hind end underneath her and cringe around, and she'd dash off again. And then she'd go around and have her head up and her chin tucked in and her tail underneath her like a dog trying to... If she didn't look funny, I don't know what it is.
She just didn't know what a whip was for, did she?
Mm-mm. So I got her going to the right, and then I turned around, and it was a lot easier on the left. A couple of times, I finally on the right rein, I just got her so that she was literally between the whip and my hand. The rope, the thing was so short, and lunged her that way, walked my circle and lunged her that way. Because otherwise, she would whirl away, get her rear end away from the whip, and sit, be standing there staring at me and wouldn't go on. If I can get Pussy to go on just by saying walk on and crack the whip once and she'll walk on. But Missy'd go straight up in the air. Old nervous mare. So I did the same thing to the left. Had her on a real short lunge and just walked her, kept her right between the whip and the head collar. And then I lengthened out and let her work. And she worked pretty calmly. I think there were a few times when she was upset, but she worked pretty well. And then I quit. And I was walking up to her, and I reached for her head. And about that same time, the whip did something, and she jumped. And I said, well, look, I had enough of this. So I just stood there and held her head and just held with the whip, just ran it all over, let her smell it, ran it between her eyes, just the lash of it between her eyes and down her neck and around her back and between her legs and all over, and then all of a sudden I'd crack it. And she never jumped, but she'd wince. And I spent about 40 minutes just at that.
Why is that
right? I worked it so I was cracking it behind her, just right behind her, just right above her quarters, about 6 inches above her quarters, and crack it there.
Well.
And around behind her, and then over to the side, and then I'd wave it in front of her, and that was what upset her, just seeing it go up and down in front of her. And I did that until she quit and snaked it in the grass in front of her, and then would snap it. You know, the double snap when you snap it one way and then the other. And, oh, I learned all sorts of things about how to handle a whip. Had great fun. I'd snap it in the air above her head and all this time just standing there.
Yeah.
Then I walked out on the lunge, just told her to woo, and cracked it, made her just stand still while she was away from me, and crack it and whip around. And then led her in and fooled around with it, swung it around in the air around her while we were walking in. And then I decided, well, there's something else she can get used to, too. And I took the end of the lunge thing and just all of a sudden reached around and hit the saddle with it. She stopped dead a second, and I did it again, and she flinched. And then I swung it over and hit the other side of the saddle with it. And then shook it in front of her head, and after a while she went to sleep. It took a while, but after a while she went to sleep.
Trusting.
Well, you see, by that time she figured out that no matter how much it shook and waved and flapped in her eyes and how loud it hit the saddle, it didn't hurt her. So, I took her in and got all that gear off of her, and so she just had saddle and bridle on, and took her out to work her under saddle. And I started off in the ring and got her to walk out, but I had to get mad at her a couple of times to get her to walk out. And one of the times, I didn't have a stick with me. I didn't take anything with me except, like, in the way of stick or spur or anything. And she was not walking out very well. And I just felt she was completely dead to my leg. I mean, I could kick her and get no response except that she'd pull her stomach up and almost stop dead, which is what I hate more than anything. So I started to pick up the end of the reins, and she nearly jumped out of her skin. And I thought, no, that's not what I want. So I just shortened my reins so that I had some control over her. I started talking to her, and then at the end of my reins, I waved that around her eyes, I waved it back and hit my leg with it, till finally she didn't pay any more attention to it. Because the point is that they aren't supposed to recognize an artificial aid. They're supposed to think it's you. And if they're afraid of it and think that it's what's going to hurt them, then they aren't thinking about what you're telling them. They're thinking about the aid, the artificial thing. That's not the point. The point is to be able to use it once and then not have to use it. And if they know it's the whip that's hitting them, and if they know it's the stick that that you're using, and if they know it's the spur or the end of the rein, then they'll know that they don't have to pay attention to it if it's just your leg. So they shouldn't ever be afraid of anything you do. Shouldn't be afraid of the whip or afraid of the movement above them.
That clear to you, Faye?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah, but I know they should.
Now that's the end of the taping on Thursday night after supper, the 4th of December 69. That's the end of the session after supper. On the 4th of December, 69, Thursday the 4th of December, 69, this is Channel 1 Right, 625.
Barbara, it's just hard for me to believe that anybody would rob the tack room at Mr. Tilt's.
Well, they did it. They do it all the time. I mean, in England, every major riding school in England's been hit once. A good many of them twice. And I rather enjoyed hearing about it because it wasn't my tack that was robbed. But
you had to use some of that old tack, didn't you?
Yeah, I had to suffer a bit for it.
Yeah.
But even so, it made a good tale. They had, the day before, there was a couple came down to look at the stable. And they wandered around and asked a lot of questions and then left.
Oh.
And I think they were driving a red MG or something like that, a red sports car. Now the next day was Monday. And on Monday nights they took a hell of a chance. Because on Monday night, what apparently they didn't really find out was that Monday nights there's a lesson that runs late, and the clients go up after they're all old clients and friends, and they go up to the house for coffee after the lesson. And it just happened that this particular Monday night, all the students except two of them went out to the pub. And they left one girl, and it happened to be Elaine, and she had, to add to everything else, she had been thrown against the boards that morning and had been asleep all afternoon. And apparently she'd been in the club room and gone back to her room and had done the one thing that's never done. She'd turned off all the lights.
Oh.
She turned off all the lights down at the stable. And that's never supposed to be done, you see. They had a great big huge yard light, spotlight, that kept the yard lit all night and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And she turned it off. And so they people apparently parked up by the lane gate. Now the lane gate's way up over the top of the hill and all across about 3 acres of level with a stand of pine trees between it and the house, and the crest of the hill between it and the stables, so you can't see it at all from the stables. And they apparently have parked a truck or something up by the lane gate and walked down through the field, which set the dogs barking, but nobody ever paid any attention to the dogs. Then they found one of the students' van, Paul's van. And Paul had left his keys in it, because nobody ever bothered to take the keys out of the cars.
Just like I do.
Yeah. And they took the van and drove it down to the tack room, and took every bit of the tack from the tack room, and they got about 30 sets of tack. Just loaded it into Paul's van. And they took all the pony tack, and about 10 or 12 sets of horse tack that had been used in the lesson, and hadn't been cleaned and put back into the office where they usually kept. And there's a burglar alarm in the attack room and the office, but it had been turned off because the clients hadn't left yet and so forth. It hadn't been turned on yet. And all the clients up at the house having coffee, and they would taste, you know, these people taking the tack out of the tack room. They left one bridle, don't know how they missed it, but they just left it, and a stirrup or something like that. And they took Celia's dressage saddle, which was, by all accounts, a beautiful thing. She'd had it made especially for Corey by a special saddler that she happened to know about, and on a special tree that she happened to like, and she'd just gotten it broken in to where it was really comfortable, and it was gone. And then they took the van and drove it up past the house, right past the house, and up the road, and turned on the lane and changed all the stuff over into their truck, and left a noseband that belonged to one of the kids' bridles. She would point to it afterwards with great pleasure. It was saved from the great tack robbery. But it wasn't very long. It couldn't have been very long after that that the kids came back. And Paul immediately took one look and said, "All right, Mike's taking my van. Where's he hid it?" And they looked all over. They looked in the school, because Mike had driven it into the school one night and left it there, sitting in the middle of the school. So they checked the school, and they looked all around, and they couldn't find the van. So they called the Blotsoms, and Mike swore he hadn't taken the van. So they finally got around to calling the police. And the police came out and searched around, and I don't know where they called the police from. I imagine they did it from the office. There wasn't a phone in the tack room. The phone was in the office, which was right next door.
Oh, next door?
Yeah. So all they would have had to do if they'd known to get all the tack would have been to look into the door next door down.
Mm.
But apparently they didn't realize they hadn't been in the office, and they didn't realize tack was kept in there. But at any rate, nobody noticed that anything was missing from the tack room. And the police came out and looked at where the van wasn't and looked around for the clues, and then they asked if anything else had been stolen. And I said, "No, not that we know of." And about this time, see, you went to get something from the tack room. And she walked in, flipped on the light, and didn't quite hit her. At first, she said it took her about a minute to realize that the tack wasn't there. So she went charging out and told the police that the tack had been stolen. And the next morning, they found the van up at the top of the hill by the lane gate with its one noseband left in it. Otherwise, all right. And they returned it to Paul. And they started asking questions around. And I feel so sorry for the other girl that was left that night. She was a new student, and it was her first day. And Celia said that the first thing they all thought about was that the police started asking questions. Anybody new around? Has anybody been asking questions? This sort of thing. And the first thing they thought about was this poor girl.
Oh.
And they all went charging just as soon as they found out about the robbery and the police left. They all went charging down to the cage boxes. And first of all, they went charging in and woke up Elaine. And Elaine went into hysterics. That's Elaine's response to any sudden surprise. It's complete hysterics. She screams. I never heard anything like it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You'll have to hear something about that later, but She went into hysterics, and then they all went down to to this girl's room and sat on her bed and just sort of stayed in the room. I don't know what they expected to do, but they stayed in the room and talked it over, in her room, and talked it over for hours. She said that none of them got any sleep that night. And when I got there, they were still having a pitchfork brigade, which meant that every night somebody had to go out and check the stables. And the pitchforks were used for cleaning the stalls, and they were kept at various points around the stables, hung on the wall. And there was always one handy. And Elaine would go out, and invariably she would see something and start screaming. And Mike loved it. He was a tease for anything, and he loved it. He would go charging out, and he and C would sneak around and suddenly burst on Elaine from odd corners. And we'd be sitting in the club room trying to listen to TV, and all of a sudden hear these shrieks, like somebody being murdered. And we'd say, oh, great, there she goes again, you know. And then she would come charging in, and she would insist that she had seen somebody. And one night she went outside, and pretty soon we heard the scream, and we knew Mike was sitting there looking at us, and Celia was there too. And she came charging in, breathless and almost knocking everything down as she came in, and said, there's somebody out there, there's somebody out there. We said, all right, so there's somebody out there. And Celia took a look out, and she gasped, and she said, Mike, there is somebody out there. Right. And I went out, and sure enough, there was somebody out there. It was Mr. Tilk. And I said goodnight to him as he went on into the house, and I went on to my room. I never did bother to go in and tell him who it was.
Well, now, you can just go to the auction and buy back your own tack.
Well, you can try to, but it's not sold in England. They take it and smuggle it across the channel and sell it in open markets in Belgium. And there was a Flemish boy who said he would sort of check around the markets, but because he knew the tack. He had been there for several months and knew the tack, but he couldn't possibly cover the markets. And the police are not very, aren't very keen on it. You know, it's just not a big enough, mm-hmm. In spite of the fact that if it were ever totaled up, it must amount to thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds a year, go out of that country in tack. The police are not very quick to follow it up. And when they were talking to C and when they were talking to the Tilks, they said, no, we can't get your tack back for you.
Mm-hmm.
They said, it's gone. We'll have Interpol agents check the markets in Belgium, but they won't find anything. And because what they do, they take it over, and some tack is marked, it's branded. You know, for instance, I'd like to do that to my saddle, brand it with my initials or something. But it's so easy for a saddler to just take off that piece of leather and replace it with another one. Or patch it. And nobody thinks anything of a patch on a saddle, an old saddle. then too, you can always rearrange parts. Switch stirrups to another saddle, switch girths, switch parts of a bridle around, change the bits. Till even people who know the tack. See, I knew the Tilk's tack, but when we started changing bits around, sometimes I'd get confused. Even though I knew that tack just perfectly. And if I looked at it closely, I could put the bridles back together right like they were to begin with. But that takes see if they were all mixed up and the parts all changed. You couldn't spot that while it was going under the auctioneer's hammer or in the market.
So it's a regular racket.
Oh, it's a racket. It's a racket. And they don't bother to just hit a place once. Fulmer was hit twice within 6 months. They waited until they got their stock built back up, and then they hit again. And they did that to one or two other of the big schools.
Now, this is a talk at breakfast on Friday the 5th of December, 69. The talk at breakfast on Friday the 5th of December, 69, the end of Channel 1 Right. We did this last night. I pushed the wrong button, and it didn't record. This is the Tilk robbery, the tack robbery, the Tilks. And this talk is continued on Channel 1 Over on the next side. This is the end of Channel 1 Right after breakfast, Friday the 5th of December, 69.